On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk youth gang adaptations with The Warriors and The Outsiders. So listen up, you boppers.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills, there will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to the Bopper or Rumble edition of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery. And Ryan, I promised you I'm not packing any weapons with me this week.
No weapons. Keep it clean.
Yeah, I'm keeping it clean.
All right. As long as it's clean. Nobody's got any hidden knives or...
No switchblades, no chains, you know, no straight razors.
Yeah. All right, right. The Warriors and the Outsiders, talk about two movies about like some youth gangs, that were both based on books, both adapted, to the film, and, both really classic movies, really coming of age, and just, one sort of a coming of age movie and one sort of like a... sort of gritty, kind of fun, you know,
exploitation sort of kind of thing.
Almost stylized, you know.
Almost a One Crazy Night film, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I was thinking about that. I was thinking about, like, our One Crazy Night. It made me think of, like, Quick Change. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, we have a problem, and now we got to get, you know, through this to get to the thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but, yeah, these two movies are both based on books. They're both about youth gangs. There's some thematic overlap between the two, but the execution of them really couldn't be any more different.
Oh yeah, I mean, even though they're stylized completely differently.
Yes,
one is set in the city in the gritty concrete jungle, and one is set in the middle of Oklahoma in a small town. You know, with the gangs really being like. The kind of the greasers versus like the popular socials, you know, or what they call the socias.
Well, let's go ahead and start with The Outsiders.
Okay. So, yeah, talking about that. So this was a movie that was made in 1993. Now, it was directed by...
1983.
Is that what I say?
The 93.
1983. Okay. I read 1983 with my eyes, but my mouth hath deceived me. Okay. It was directed by Francis Ford Coppola, 92 minutes long. The budget was $10 million, and stars some pretty heavy hitters.
A pretty amazing cast,
pretty big cast. I'll go through the cast real quick. See Thomas Howell, Matt Dillon, Ralph Macchio, Patrick Swayze, Rob Lowe, Emilio Estevez, Tom Cruise, Diane Lane, Leif Garrett, and even a brief, kind of like in one scene that you may not even know.
Oh, no.
Waits.
I'm a big Tom Waits fan, so I definitely, it's like, hey, it's Tom Waits.
Tom Waits. I don't think he has any lines, but you're like, hey, that's that. I know that guy.
Yeah.
But really, a lot of, students know this film. A lot of people know this film because they watched it in high school because it was based on the book.
Yeah. The book of the same name by an author by the name of C.E. Hinton. And I actually read it in school in junior high.
And C.E. Hinton, by the way, was a female. So I don't know what her actual first name is. I didn't look that up, but so we get that out there.
Yeah, I've never seen it listed anywhere, but I have very fond memories of the book. I read it at a very formative time in my life, you know, and the movie follows the book pretty closely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think I remember seeing this movie. I don't know if I saw it in class or not in class. But, you know, it was one of those movies that you would watch, like, in English class, and you would watch it, like, over several days, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Several class days, and you would just kind of talk about it, because it is one of these great, you know, it has poetry in it. There's also other books mentioned, like Gone with the Wind, and it just touches on a lot of things about, you know, social class, and about growing up, and about, you know, dealing with orphanism, dealing with... loss of parents, dealing with, you know, just gangs and kind of like finding your way and really growing up between that period of, you know, becoming a kid to, you know, come in grips with like sort of reality and those challenges. Yeah,
the kind of awkward thing when you are not really a child and you're not really a grown up either.
Right.
And it says a lot about the idea of conflict and how kind of physical confrontation is really futile, how it doesn't really change anything. It doesn't really help us grow into being better people. It's kind of just a waste of time.
Right. In a lot of ways, it's kind of like sort of a movie about, like, I relate it kind of a similar kind of book to Catcher in the Rye, where it's kind of in that in-between period, you know, transitioning to adulthood. And, you know, they mention the poem, you know, that the two characters mention as, you know, nothing gold can stay, meaning you can't stay a kid forever, right?
Yes.
So,
As I say, that you eventually lose that childhood innocence, yes.
Yeah, so now we've gone over, like, we've gone backwards. We've kind of, like, gone over, like, what the sort of... overall gist is. Let me just go over the plot summary right quick. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, in 1965, 14-year-old Pony Boy Curtis is the youngest of three orphan brothers who live on the north side of town, the wrong side of the tracks. Sensitive Pony Boy used to have a good relationship with his older brother Daryl, but since Daryl became the household caregiver, he is always on Pony Boy's case. Caught in the middle is the third brother, Soda Pop, who dropped out of school to work full-time. I lost my place. They all belong to the Greasers, a gang of boys from the north side who is also from working-class families, often broken. Ponyboy's main concern is that any problem they may encounter, especially in their Greaser activities, will lead to the authorities splitting up their family. He also believes Daryl would have outgrown them and become something in his life if it wasn't for his loyalty to the gang and need to take care of the family. The rest of the world sees the Greasers as all the same, the face being Dallas Winston, the most volatile one who has just been released from prison.
Yeah, and so Dallas is played by Matt Dillon, who's kind of like the volatile one of the group for sure.
Yeah.
Patrick Swayze plays Daryl, or as they call him in the movie, Derry.
Yeah, they all kind of have southern accents, so they, you know, he's become Derry. And you know, it's like. And C. Thomas Howell, you know, he talks in the movie, like, when he's talking to the you know, so it's like the Greasers, that's them. They all have grease in their hair. They look like they're from the movie Grease, you know. And then there's the what they call the Socias, or the they're the popular, you know, kids.
Yeah.
Wearing, like, the polo shirts and, you know, and slacks and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, C. Thomas Howell's character is named Pony Boy. Like, that's his real name. And he talks about his brother, Soda Pop Curtis, who's played by Rob Lowe, meaning he's like, yeah, Soda Pop, you know, it's on his birth certificate and everything. So you kind of get the idea that this is like sort of, you know, lower class families, you know, small town. It mentions that, like, that Derry, Patrick Swayze, he's a roofer, you know, and like Soda Pop, he just works at the gas station pumping gas.
He's a high school dropout, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's even like, and then there's also, I just want to note that this is the second movie with Patrick Swayze and C. Thomas Howell, where Patrick Swayze's playing like the kind of the older, more mature one of the group, and C. Thomas Howell kind of playing the younger person of the group, like in Red Dawn, that was done like just, what was it, a year or two later, 1984?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but like in that movie, they weren't blood relatives, but he did kind of play like an older brother type of figure.
Yeah.
True, true. Yeah. Because Swayze's got that kind of innate decency about him. Like, he just seems like he'd be your big brother.
Yeah.
And because he kind of played that a lot in his career when he was younger. Like, even in, like, he even kind of develops that relationship with Keanu Reeves in Point Break, where he's kind of like got this, like, older brother quality to him, even in a movie like Point Break.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he has just, like, that really young, like, really clean, chiseled face. And he's just, like, you know, he's really intense, you know. That's why he kind of scares, you know, C. Thomas Howell while they run off. But, you know, the main part of the film is where, you know, Ralph Macchio's character, Johnny Cade, wound up, you know, kind of accidentally stabbing one of the socias, you know, as they got into a fight in the park.
Mm-hmm. And then Putty Boy and him have to run off, basically, to hide.
Yeah, kind of hide, yeah.
Yeah, the movie and the book are pretty brisk. There's not
Have
a lot.
Have you read the book?
Yeah, I read it in the seventh grade.
So. Okay, so you did actually read the whole book.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Okay. I don't think we read the book. I just watched the movie.
Yeah, it's pretty brisk. I mean, it's kind of thing that you could give a 12-year-old and they would be willing to sit down and read.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it's not like it's Gone with the Wind or anything.
Right. Yeah, like really not very complex sentences, very straightforward.
Yeah, and the story really matters to someone that age. Like, imagine reading that, having that story when you were the age of, like, Pony Boy, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It resonates.
I mean, yeah, I think I was about the age, or maybe a couple of years younger when I saw it. So, yeah, I could completely relate, and I mean, I remember going, you know, to the drive-in movie theater and stuff like that at that time and being awkward talking to girls and stuff like that and, you know, having to realize that there's these weird social classes now. You just think, you know, everybody kind of grows up like, you know, in elementary school and stuff and, oh, we're all just all the same. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get older and like, oh, you have this class and that class. Like, we're from this side of town or that side of town. And, yeah. And it's very apparent those differences between the two of them.
Yeah, that age is really when it becomes apparent.
Yeah.
So, but there's a lot of great actors in the film, as you were saying. There's a lot of fun side characters. I gotta say, my favorite side character in the entire thing is Emilio Estevez as 2-Bit.
Oh yeah,
he's so much fun.
He's so much fun, and he nails that part so well. I think Rob Lowe was the only character that was his first movie. Everybody else, believe it or not, as young as they were, had been in other movies before this movie. But like this was Rob Lowe's first movie. But yeah, Emilio Estevez just does a great job of. He kind of plays like a. He's not really involved, but it's almost like not really comic relief, but kind of like a. You know, he's kind of camaraderie. He's kind of like the pal that just kind of hangs around and is more fun. And
yeah, well, everyone had a friend growing up who just joked all the time, who just constantly laughed and was the funny guy. And that's really Emilio Estevez in this movie, and he's really great in him. He's really fun. He brings a lot of levity to the film when there's not really much else. There's not really a lot of humor in it except for him. And it's a really great performance, and I've always thought he's a very underappreciated actor.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great supporting role from him. And on the flip side, I thought Tom Cruise was terrible.
His southern accent is so bad in The Outsiders.
It wasn't just his accent. It was like he was smiling the whole time. Like he was like, yeah, I'm in this movie with all these people, and this is so much fun. And you're just like... You're supposed to be like a serious greaser, like, you know, kind of intense, like I'm super cool, you know, like Matt Dillon. I mean, I think Matt Dillon as Dally, like, played it really well.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I think because Cruz, one thing I say is Cruz's part is very, very small.
Yeah, it is. He's only in like about two or three scenes, and he's not. He only has a handful of lines. But yeah, it's. I just thought. I think he was trying to play sort of the same sort of role as 2-Bit, but he was like he looked way too good looking to be a greaser.
Yeah, like, and he's super buff, and which is also kind of distracting because all the other guys look kind of normal and like regular people, and then you got Tom Cruise looking like a 20-year-old god. And it's a little bit distracting. You tell that, oh yeah, that guy's clearly, you know, a movie star, and the rest of these guys are actors, you know?
Yeah. I mean, even Rob Lowe almost looks, you know, like too good to be in the movie. And he actually was almost cast as a Socia, but he said, no, I don't want to be a Socia in this movie. I want to be a greaser.
Well, and Rob's part's pretty small in it too. I mean, like he's only in kind of like, he's never in a scene that just focuses on him at any point.
The final scene, sort of the ending scene where they like run to the park and,
that's true. Yeah, but even then, he's never really the main focus in the scene. Like, I mean, he's always kind of a side character within the film. Really, the movie's mostly about C. Thomas Howell, Matt Dillon, and Ralph Macchio.
Yeah, but I really enjoyed Rob Lowe's sort of like monologue at the end about, you know, we can't fight, we have to stick together, kind of thing.
Yeah, that was a good. It's a good bit of writing for sure.
Yeah. Because I think it kind of like it was a good thing to kind of like wrap the movie up together because you had Ralph Macchio. You know, they so after they hide out, you know, in the church or whatever, a week or whatever, they're driving home. Like Dally is driving them home. They see like a burning church with kids and. They convince him to stop, and so the Johnny and you know Pony Boy help out to try to get the kids out, you know, of the church, and the roof wound up collapsing, and that's what you know Johnny got, you know, burns, and eventually you know wound up dying because of his injuries.
Yeah,
and I mean it's just like a really. It left like a really sort of sad note, and I think that they wanted, you know, the writer definitely wanted to end it more on a positive note of carrying it forward, and I thought it was really great, like, the reading of the letter and just everything, you know, just kind of like wrapping up all the loose ends.
Yeah, it wraps up in a very kind of sweet way, like, you know, where it's bittersweet, where it's not super like weepy sad, but you feel like you've been on an emotional journey. So what did you think of the film, Ryan? Did you like it? You know, how did you feel about it?
Well, I know this was, I remember commenting like, I don't remember this music being in here. And then I realized that like, this is a new director's cut version. And there were some other scenes and stuff like that were in there. And I was like, wait, where's the scene where they talk about like the rabbit or like, you know, trying to catch a rabbit or whatever. And I mean, it was like all these Elvis tunes that were in there. I was like, oh my gosh, like all these Elvis, like B sides and B cuts from the time period were in there that I didn't remember the first time, but I did enjoy it. It was still great, but yeah, it's still kind of like as one of those kind of slice of life almost kind of. I think it would have worked better like in the 70s, sort of like those kind of slice of life kind of films. But I still think it's a great coming of age film. And I've always really liked C. Thomas Howell as an actor because of this film. And just, you know, it's unfortunate that he did, you know, like his career kind of went where it was after doing Blackface and doing Soul Man. But, in 2020 doesn't really, you know, bode well, but
even at the time we were all like, he's doing what now?
Like, I don't think this is a good idea. But yeah, it's, but you know, I think that Ralph Macchio's performance is one of his finer performances too, you know, outside of the Karate Kid. I mean, It really shows, like, you know, his sort of range and, like, you know, and apparently, like, reading through the notes, like, he was very serious about his role.
Yeah. Well, Johnny's really is really the heart of the movie. I mean, it's, I mean, he's, if you don't care about what happens to Johnny, then nothing else in the movie really matters, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, but, like, in the scene where they're, like, running away and, like, he talks about, like, you know, he's thinking about, like, killing himself. It's just, like, very sad. Like, who yeah. mentions that in a book or in a movie? I mean, you know, it gets very real, like, very sort of quickly. I mean, it, like, first it, like, oh, they're joking around with the girls, and then, like, the next time he's, you know, so, but yeah, it reminded me a lot of, like, Stand By Me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little more stylized for sure. Like, one thing that really struck me watching it now as the movie nerd I've grown into is how very stylized the whole thing was. There's lots of, like, rear projection shots where the actors are clearly on, like, a set, and they're, like, and like, the sunset is being projected onto a screen behind them.
Those were very certain, really cheesy look. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily cheesy. I think it's an intentional look. I think it's an intentional choice. It kind of looks like films from the time period where the movie took place. It kind of looked like movies from the 50s, but with the story about the 50s.
You know? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because he's talking about being like Steve McQueen or whatever, like coming out of the theater. Like, that's how the movie starts.
Yeah.
Is that what you're kind of talking about?
Yeah. Like? I mean, so I think Coppola intentionally wanted it to kind of look like the movies of that time period.
I think you wanted a little more, like, dreamy kind of look, like,
yes,
you know, and I know that in the movie there's dialogue that's written, you know, that's this inner dialogue from the character, and it's like, how are you going to show that visually?
Yeah, and that's a stylized choice. Right? Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It's just always like you say, tricky.
But like you say, it's a stylized choice. It's still like, you know how it's going to end and you know how it's going to be. And it's very sort of sad at the time. And it really makes you think about, you know, made me think about my, you know, upbringing and childhood and like kind of what I was thinking back then. But yeah, I mean, the dealing with, you know, manslaughter and murder and death, I mean, those are some serious subjects to tackle from, you know, sort of a child perspective, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Thankfully, the movie has got a very brisk pace, and it really just chugs along. But yeah, I think when you're a kid and rereading this story or watching the film for the first time, it kind of gets you thinking about some of the more harsh realities of life in a way that's kind of digestible when you're young. I get why they kind of introduced that book to us when we're young, because it really helps you learn about that there aren't a lot of happy endings in life. I mean, sometimes the good people die. Sometimes, you know, these bad things happen. And that's The Outsiders is really kind of a book that really kind of eases kids into those concepts, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I personally really enjoyed revisiting it. I've not seen it all the way through probably since I was a kid. So I really enjoyed going back and watching it. I was, like I said, I was surprised how quickly it moved. It was just a real smooth watch for me. Like, you know, by the time I really settled in, it was over, and I'm like, yeah, that was enjoyable.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's only 92 minutes, so it's refreshing. Both of these movies actually are right at 92 minutes exactly.
Yeah.
So I mean, you got an hour and a half. I mean, that's like two regular TV episodes if you're watching on, like, you know, Netflix or something like that. So if you can binge watch two shows, you can watch one of these movies.
Yeah, in this current age of, like, really bloated runtimes for movies, where, like, every movie is like 2 hours and 12 minutes, it's really refreshing to watch a 90-minute film. Like, just brevity. I appreciate that, you know.
Yeah, and to watch, you know, these sort of youngsters, and to watch, like, you know, the change. One of the things I really liked about it was to see sort of the change in the characters, and you see change in, like, see Thomas Howell's character from start to finish, and that was really fulfilling for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so I mentioned that 2-Bit was my favorite character in the film. There's so many great characters in this movie. Who's your favorite character in The Outsiders, Ryan?
Oh, it's Ponyboy, man. It's got to be Ponyboy.
He does a great job with that Robert Frost monologue, for sure. Yeah. in the middle of the film. He really nails it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I really sort of identified with his character, because he's just kind of, you know, he's just kind of bopping along himself. He doesn't want to get into fights. He's a greaser, but he doesn't really feel like he's, like, you know, totally in the greaser, but he doesn't like being picked on by the Sochas. And, I really can identify with that, and like wanting to see movies and wanting to read books and, you know, that kind of thing.
And be kind of being stuck in this conflict. Yeah.
Yeah. He just kind of feels like caught in the middle of it all, you know?
Yeah. Well, speaking of bopping along, let's talk about the Warriors.
Yeah. The Warriors. Now, I had never seen this film.
And I had been trying to get you to watch it for months.
We have other movies to watch, yeah. Man. I can't watch them all the time. Yeah.
But, you know, but this was one that from day one of video culture, I was like, we got to do the Warriors. You know?
Yeah. No, and I remember I came to you with a list of movies that I wanted to do. And I said, okay, you know, when we're coming up with plans for 2020, I'm like, these are the movies I want to do. Now, I don't know if we can fit them all in this year, but I want to do them. And this was one of the movies on the list.
Mm-hmm. Like from the very beginning.
Yeah. Because I know you know a film's like sort of reach when you see it in other like pop culture and other pop, you know, media. And when it's been so stylized and so, you know, riffed by, you know, other media. I mean, the Simpsons, you know, Family Guy, countless other movies and TV shows.
Hey, also music videos too. Like there's more than one music video that directly homages the Warriors.
Right. I mean, even like Twisted Sister and like,
yeah,
you know, all this stuff. So it's like, you know, as influential as it is, and even watching the movie, I then figured out even more like reach that it has. And I was like, oh my gosh, this explains, you know, this sort of thing and that sort of thing. Like, oh my God, like now I kind of get it.
Yeah.
Because
it's literally chocked full of iconic moments.
Yeah. Like you can watch like the bathroom fight scene between, you know, the Warriors and the Punks is like a direct influence on Michael Jackson's Bad video.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm like, holy cow, that probably influenced the whole song, probably influenced the whole album. I can just see Michael Jackson just like loving this movie. Yeah, I really like the Warriors. You know.
Well, I do know.
Felt like he wanted to be in like a Warrior. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I do know for a fact that Ice-T and Ice Cube were huge Warriors fans, and that's why they ended up doing that movie Trespass, which I wrote about on the website. That's actually why they ran that movie, because it's directed by the same guy. And they said they mainly did it because they wanted to hang out with the director and ask him questions about the Warriors.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. Well, let's talk about it like right quick. So for people that don't know, The Warriors, it was directed by Walter Hill, who we talked about Walter Hill because he directed Brewster's Millions.
Mm-hmm.
He also directed The Driver, 48 Hours, Another 48 Hours, The Getaway, Red Heat. And it was also produced by another guy who's produced a lot of big movies, Lawrence Gordon, who produced Predator, Die Hard, Point Break, Boogie Nights, Lara Croft, Tomb Raider. I mean, he's like, you know, he's not like a Jerry Bruckheimer, but he's definitely like one of those Jerry Bruckheimer action film, you know, sort of dudes, you know.
Yeah, he's been behind a lot of big movies, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then weirdly enough, the executive producer was Frank Marshall.
Yeah, it's pretty odd, yeah.
Frank Marshall, for those that also don't know, I mean, he's responsible for Happy Days, and, you know, he's directed movies like The Princess Diaries, and he does these like wholesome films, and I'm like, why is his name on here? And I don't know. I think it was just because it was Paramount, and it was like he's just the executive producer, just providing money. Like, okay, Paramount wants to do this movie. Yeah, this looks good. I'll be your executive producer. I'll be your Huckleberry. I don't know how he got involved, to be quite honest. I don't know. But it was 92 minutes long, and the budget was $4 million, 1979. And doesn't really still have a whole lot of stars. It's almost like the opposite of The Outsiders, where you have a bunch of people, you have a couple people from movies that you may have seen before, but not a whole lot.
Yeah, the biggest one I can think of is James Remar, who was on that Showtime show Dexter, and he did a lot of other movie work too. But he played Ajax, one of the members of the Warriors. He's the one who likes to fight so much.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's the Warriors' short-tempered main enforcer.
Yes.
And then Michael Beck, he plays like the main lieutenant. I mean, I've seen he's sort of the second in command who becomes the new warlord. Mm-hmm. And he's been in some other things, but he's always, you know, played kind of like supporting roles in other things.
Yeah, well, there is one name that we can't forget because he's actually a Video Culture alumni, and that's David Patrick Kelly, who's the main villain of this movie. He was the main villain in The Crow.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right, which is, yeah, it's, you know, the Warriors. So... He's the guy that you know, where the iconic scene at the end where...
Bangs the bottles together.
Yeah.
Warriors! Yeah. You gotta say, you gotta do it nasally and have your voice crack, you know?
You're better at it than me.
I do it all the time. I just don't tell anyone.
Well, this is one of your favorite movies.
It is. I've seen it dozens of times, yeah.
So why is it one of your favorite movies? And tell us about, like, maybe the first time you saw it.
Well, the first time I saw it was on TV. On TNT, you know, TNT used to do like movies for guys. So I think this thing called Movies for Guys movies, where they would show like dad movies, like Van Damme movies, Stallone movies, Chuck Norris movies, and they would show the Warriors. For years, I would just catch like the Warriors like half an hour into it or like an hour into it. And I'd watch like the rest of the film. For years, I never saw the beginning of it. I'm like, this movie's so cool. I don't know what's going on or why they're running. But this is so cool because they wear like these iconic costumes and they're fighting these cool villains who look like cartoon comic book villains with like bats and face paint and like crazy outfits. And as like a kid who liked comic books and like pro wrestling, the look of the movie was very iconic to me. And then it seems so gritty yet so stylized at the same time. And it's got so much cool dialogue.
Yeah.
And it's just such a unique movie, and it moves, man. Once it gets going, it never lets up, and it's so engrossing.
Yeah, I mean, I told you, I mean, I think my first comments about the movie since I've never seen it was that, you know, it walks like a really thin line between like being like sort of serious movie and fun and being pretentious. And I think that, you know, one step one way or the other, and it's not going to work.
Yeah, it can so easily be silly, and it just isn't. It's fun.
Yeah, because, I mean, think about it. I mean, okay, let's go over the synopsis right quick so we can talk about it. Where'd it go? I lost it, man. I lost it. Give me a moment. Talk amongst yourselves. But yeah, it's basically like, you know, and once again, it's also an adaptation, of a book. Now, have you read this book?
I have not. It was written by a guy named Saul Yorick in 1962. I do know a little bit about it. The book was way more serious. It was meant to be more of a realistic depiction of gangs at the time because Saul worked as a social worker in New York. Mm-hmm. And it was meant to be more reflective of what he saw at the time. It was meant to be like he was actually meant to be a response to the popularity of West Side Story. Because West Side Story was very this sanitized look at gangs.
Like a fun version. Yeah.
It was like, yeah, they're all, you know, once you're a shark, you're the shark, all, you know, all that nonsense.
You actually know some of the songs?
I like musicals, so we're not going to go into that right now. But he thought, well, no, gangs aren't really like that. You know, gangs are terrible. And so he wrote this book about his experiences and are the things he saw from the kids he basically was a social worker for. And it's a really some of the structure is the same. It's not nearly as like stylized or like out there. But like some of the conflicts are similar, but the kids are much younger, and it's a lot more violent and gritty and dark and really sad. The book is, from what I can understand, the book is a lot bleaker in tone than the film. The movie really makes it more of a cartoon. The book is very realistic.
I wouldn't say cartoon. I would say comic book.
Yes.
All right. So storyline is Cyrus, the leader of the most powerful gang in New York City, the Gramercy Riffs, calls a midnight summit for all the area gangs, with all asked to send 9 unarmed representatives for the conclave. A gang called the Warriors are blamed for killing Osiris. He gives, as he gives his speech, they now have to cross the territory of rivals in order to get to their own hood. The Warriors slowly cross the dangerous Bronx and Manhattan territories, narrowly escaping police and other gangs every step of the way. So, yeah, I mean, it just, you start off with everybody, like, sort of traveling in the middle of the night, like, as it gets dark, to this park, which I assume was Central Park. It's not Central Park, but, and then you have this big meeting, and you have this Cyrus, this sort of, like, you know, big sort of leader guy, like, telling everybody.
Almost not a messiah figure, in a way.
Yeah, this messiah figure going, don't, you know, don't fight over this foot of turf. Like, let's all work and just, like, take everything that we can and, you know, just, you know, get settled in because we outnumber the cops, like, 5-1, basically. Yeah. And then in the middle of it, as everybody's getting excited, like, somebody shoots him, which...
Yeah, and it wasn't the Warriors. They're framed for it. That's one thing.
Yeah, they're framed for it. That's what I was getting to. Yeah. Somebody shoots him. With, you know, we see the person who shoots him was David Patrick Kelly, whose character's name is Luther, who's the warlord of the Rogues. But then he blames it on the Warriors because one of the Warriors actually saw him do it. So he blames them. And so everybody believes him because he's like, you know, he did it, he did it, he did it. And then, it just became like, so now it's like a race to get back to their own territory. And so it's like, you get set up for the plot or what, you know, what we call or what everybody calls the MacGuffin very early on in the film. Like, you really understand because you see all the gangs, they're all represented there. And you see what the problem is, and you see what the conflict is right away.
Ryan, you're dropping out, man.
And you know, okay, that's what this movie is going to be about. Okay, sorry.
Hey, Ryan, you dropped out. You dropped out quite a bit there, man.
Dropping out.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, but I lost like the whole last two sentences you said.
Okay.
So let's double back to where you said.
Oh, well, okay. So basically, I was just stating that, like, you know, we know very early on in the film, like, where we're going. We know the plot. We know, like, instantly within the first 5 minutes, we know what the rest of this film is going to be about and what we're about to see.
Yeah.
And, like, where it's going to end. Like, it's not going to take us into, like, weeks and months go by. It's going to all happen, like, within, like, a... like almost 12-hour period, like not even 24 hours.
Yeah, there's not many subplots. There's really only one other subplot about a girl who joins up with them halfway through. It's very focused.
Yeah,
which I appreciate. It's a very lean, kind of mean film. But let's go back to the beginning for a moment. I gotta say, to me, The Warriors has one of the greatest opening 15 minutes of any film I've ever seen. The way they just introduce all of the gangs coming into the park, and they show the Warriors kind of talking to each other about what's going to go on that night, and you hear a little bit about who the Cyrus guy is as they're showing all these different colorful gangs kind of filing in. It's so iconic.
Well, we talked about Walter Hill like being just like a visual director, and I think that first 5 minutes, as you see, like, And the gangs, like, they're all, like, you know, wearing colors or vests or something like that, like they are in the movie Grease or something, which is kind of silly to be in this gang with, like, you know, this vest that says the Warriors on the back of it or something, or they're all wearing their colors or whatever. But you have to, you basically, like, it is really stylized to, like, you know... That's where you get, you know, and the colors are really hot and they really pop. Like, it's very a contrasty film to like show all of that, you know, where it's like, you know, really rich, dark blacks and really like hot colors to really make it look like you're looking at a, like a comic book. And even the way that the line delivery is very sort of deliberate, like they almost have like little bubbles over their head or whatever. Cause it's almost like the dialogue is almost kind of like broken up. And, but yeah, you get very quickly, you put together, he puts the story together very interestingly in that first 5 minutes with that eerie music and, you know, all the other stuff about that showing like New York City and the subway and the, you know, all this other stuff.
Yeah. And this, in Cyrus's speech where he talks about uniting the gangs, that's one of the most memorable parts of the entire movie where he's like, "Can you count, suckers?"
Yeah, you know? I mean, you're just like, they talk about the Cyrus, like, what is the Cyrus guy? The Cyrus guy, there's all these whispers.
Yeah.
And then he just comes out, and it's like this perfect delivery.
Yeah.
You know, to
he's magnetic. Know. He really is. Yeah. And he talks about, again, how they outnumber the cops 5-1. And it's just, it's like this really rousing speech. And of course, he ends everything with, "Can you dig it?" And it should be silly. It should be the silliest thing in the world. But the way he just commits to it, and everyone's cheering. Yeah. It's just it's badass.
Yeah,
you know, it's so it's just cool.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so true of most of the film. It's just it's cool.
Yeah, I mean, even Lynn Thigpen is like this radio DJ. I mean, and I've seen this trope. Like in several films, you know, in several like different, you know, media where you have like this microphone and then you have this like soul, like almost jive, like, you know, talk about you listen out there, boppers. And it's like she just a perfect delivery of that. And where she's almost like speaking in code.
Yeah.
You know, to all the member gangs. I mean, it's just like, you know, I was like, holy cow, like this is where it originated. This is where this like thing came from.
Yeah. And speaking of, again, bopping, I love how they have their own slang. Like when they talk about fighting, they don't use the word fight. They never say we've got to fight our way out. They say we've got to bop our way out. And they have all these little terms that they don't ever explain, but you figure out what they mean by context.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love when a movie just throws you into itself and it's like, figure it out. And I love that. I love when movies don't hold your hand.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, and even all the gangs are like, they're all tied together, not because of like their turf or like their neighborhood. I mean, you have like the Orphans and the Lizzies and, you know, like,
the Gramercy Riffs.
Exactly. Like they're, you know, you can tell like, okay, well, the Gramercy Riffs are probably like from Gramercy Park or whatever, but but they're riffs, like they're, you know, really cool. But yeah, and everybody is like costume. I mean, even the punks like have their face painted like almost like Kiss, but they're in baseball outfits.
Yeah, the baseball Furies.
Yeah,
who are probably really the most iconic gang of the Warriors, which is funny because they don't really do much. They kind of just get their butts kicked.
Yeah, they do, but they're intimidating looking with the you know, with the face paint and with the baseball bats. I mean.
I would say that, and their scene is almost like something out of a horror film when they're chasing the Warriors. It really is kind of a horror movie vibe.
The bus is like, driving by, and they have to like cross the road to get to the, you know, the entrance of the L train or whatever, or the subway, and they're chasing them down.
Well, that's the scene with the Turnbull ACs. I'm talking about like when the baseball Furies are like running after them on foot.
And they
think they lose them for a moment, but then you see them like crest the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're kind of silhouetted against the night sky with that really striking face paint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you also have this, like, because the leader is, like, missing, you kind of have this, like, struggle for control. You know, everybody in the Warriors kind of gets, like, broken up, but they're all still trying to make their way back to the beach, back to Coney Island. And, you know, make it back to Coney Island, like right at dawn or whatever, where, you know, you can see that iconic, you know, scene with the three bottles there, Coke bottles or whatever.
Oh, yeah, like they finally make it back to Coney Island at the end, and Luther and his gang are actually waiting for them there. And for some reason, Luther is calling them out. He's got three bottles on his hand. And he's playing them together, and he does, "The whole Warriors come out to play." Mm-hmm. And he says it, he repeats it, and that leads into, like, the final conflict of the movie, where you think they're going to have a big rumble.
Mm.
But the Gramercy Riffs show up at the last minute, and proving that they know that Luther killed Cyrus, and they basically helped the Warriors get out of this conflict that they weren't going to win.
Mm. Right.
But again, the Warriors are kind of like the Outsiders. The Warriors has a moment where they're like, "Why are we fighting like this?" Like when they get back to Coney Island, they're kind of looking at Coney Island, and Swan, the war chief of the Warriors, says, "This is what we were fighting all night to get back to."
Yeah, this is our turf. Yeah,
and you see like these broken down buildings and like the cruddy Ferris wheel, and he's like,
"Yeah,
this is it. This is what we wanted to get back to so bad." And it's got a kind of a melancholy quality to it.
Right, exactly. And then you're thinking, like, just because you're back at your own turf, does that necessarily mean that you're safe? Or that, you know, because it really doesn't, because they're still like, well, it's not over yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's got a little bit of that thought that the whole thing is kind of futile and silly because Cyrus was right. I mean, they're just fighting over these little things that really are meaningless,
right?
And that's the same thing that's true in the Outsiders. It's all just kind of futile and pointless, but that's all they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like why are we even in this game? Like I just, you know, so I mean, even like the orphans, you know, or whatever, like. You know, when they come up to the orphans, like the orphans don't want to fight. I mean, they're doing everything they can not to fight, but still show that they're tough. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like,
and it's like, but you can tell, like, they don't want to fight at all.
Yeah, one of my favorite little funny things that's subtly funny is like the leader of the orphans shows them a newspaper clipping to try to prove how tough they are. He's like, "Look, the paper's right about us." And he literally has a newspaper clipping in a baggie that he brings out and shows them. Like, hey, this is our rep. We've been written about in the paper. Right. And that always struck me as so funny for some reason. Like, it's such a little petty thing to try to prove how tough they are. And it just always amused me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but I initially thought it's just, like you said, though, it's really fun. It really kind of, like, grabs you and you really realize that, like, even though there's some violence in it, like, it's just going to be fun, and it's really, like, really awesome, too, to see kind of, like, New York City at that time. Oh, and yeah. I even had to go and look. I went on, like, Wikipedia maps and, like, looked at the park where they're at, which is the – I'll tell you what's the name of the park. What was the name of the park? Because it's not Central Park. Van Cortlandt.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Which is, like, really far north. I mean, it's on the northern edge of what anybody would consider, like, New York City and the Bronx. And then you got to get all the way to Coney Island, which is, like, the southernmost side of, like, Brooklyn, basically, like, Brighton Beach area. And yeah, it's like...
It's meant to be, like, this epic journey, you know? Like, yeah. I mean, it's kind of got, like, a little bit of an Odysseus quality to it. Right down to, like, there's even, like, these sirens who try to lure them to their doom and distract them from their quest, you know?
Exactly.
It's got a little bit of that, you know, mythology quality to it.
I never thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, because the siren, like the girl that was sitting on the park bench.
Yeah, well, I'm talking that's about right. like the Lizzies, you know, who are like, hey,
oh, yeah, like, or like the Lizzies. Yeah, that's the same thing, almost the same thing too, yeah.
And this is probably the first, I watched it yesterday, and I was like, for the first time ever, I realized, oh, yeah, the Lizzies are a gay gang. I never quite put that together until right now.
You never thought about that then?
It never occurred to me, yeah. Like, huh.
Yeah, and I think they do, too. They're like, oh, okay, the Lizzies. Like, that's interesting. You know, they don't even, you know, think anything of it at the time. And they're like,
yeah.
Till the one guy starts putting it all together. He's like, oh, wait, hold on.
So this is
not what we think it is.
Well, and much like the Outsiders, Ryan, there's a lot of great characters in the Warriors. So who's your favorite character in the Warriors?
That's hard to say, like who my favorite character was there. I think, you know, I don't think that you can make this without Cyrus, like you say, because he's like such a magnetic personality, this like cult of personality kind of, you know, leader. I also like the other leader too, the leader of the Gramercy Griffs, the Gramercy Griffs.
Oh yeah.
He plays
Tell me about these warriors.
Yeah, I mean he's kind of like Cyrus as well, but like very, you know, like soldieristic or whatever. And the way that he was like addressing his gang, and they're all like lined up like soldiers. And, you know, I thought he did just like an awesome job of being that sort of leader of the the Gramercy Riffs.
Like, I've used the word a lot, but just iconic. Like, I mean, like instantly you're like, that's a striking image.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, definitely everybody's a character. Like, nobody is the same at all. Everybody's just this weird, not really, it's like sort of caricature, you know, sort of, or whatever, you know what
it,
I
like
mean?
It is, it's like a subtle character. It's like light, it's heightened. It's not like farcical, but it's like heightened. I have to say, I think my favorite character I end up enjoying more and more the more I watch it is Luther as the main bad guy. He's really? Just so like unabashedly evil for no reason other than just to be evil.
Yeah.
And I really kind of appreciate how weaselly he is.
Mm-hmm.
Like I find him just very, very fun to watch him be weaselly.
Mm-hmm.
Like when someone asks him why he's doing it or why he's so excited, he's like, because I'm having a good time. Like that's his whole justification for being this bad person. It's just fun. And I really kind of dig that and find that enjoyable to watch.
I think that's just your cynical old age.
It's just he's having such a good time doing it. The sense of fun and energy he brings to it really works for me, and he really adds a lot to it. He's a great villain. He really is.
Yeah, he's definitely, you know, gives everybody a hard time no matter where he goes. I mean, even like the clerk at the store, you know, she's like, "Well, you gotta pay for that." He's like, "For what?" You know.
Yeah, and the minute he loses, he immediately starts whining in a very satisfying way.
Yeah,
like he gives you the satisfaction of, oh, he's really getting his comeuppance, and he knows he's getting his comeuppance. You know, like what a great, it's just a great bad guy performance. It's so good.
Yeah, it definitely is. Villainized to be, you know, like a villain, almost like a Jokerish type of character.
Yeah,
you know?
Very much so. Yeah.
But yeah, I enjoyed, you know, Thigpen. I mean, she's done like Carmen Sandiego, right? Like she's done other stuff.
He basically was playing the same character in the Carmen Sandiego show on PBS.
Yeah,
it's so funny to me that so many kids grew up with that show. Have no idea that it was based on a really ultra-violent movie from, like, the 1970s.
Yeah, I know. Was it ultra-violent? Would you think it's ultra-violent?
Well, for nowadays, no. But, I mean, for the time, it was pretty violent. I mean...
Yeah.
But nowadays, no.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, they were talking about, like, you know, stealing and robbing and fighting and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it was very... you know, you had those kind of gangs, you know, back in the, you know, 70s and 80s and, yeah, it's just a different time. So, well, let's get on to the notes, because I got a lot of notes.
Let's do it, man.
Quickly, we'll do quickly. Outsiders, we went over, it's based on a 1967 novel. So the idea, so you probably wonder why Francis Ford Coppola, you know, in 83, you know, I mean, he did The Conversation. Like we talked about doing, he's done The Godfather. Like, why would he do this movie like The Outsiders based on this book? Well, and I don't know if you know this or not, but a school librarian from the Lone Star Elementary School in Fresno, California, Jo Allen Misican, wrote to Coppola on behalf of her 7th and 8th grade students about adapting The Outsiders. So she talked to the class and they all decided that he ought to direct this movie. So she wrote a letter. She sent him the book. He read the book and was completely inspired to do it. And it also inspired Coppola to also adapt and direct Rumblefish, starring Mickey O'Rourke and Matt Dillon, which he did like a year or two later, I think.
Hmm.
Mickey O'Rourke, Scott Baio, Dennis Quaid, Anthony Michael Hall, and Leonardo DiCaprio also auditioned for roles in The Outsiders. But were not cast. A lot of them went out for other reasons, for other projects, that sort of thing. But also Brooke Shields and Sarah Jessica Parker. So,
no matter what, it would have had a really iconic cast. I mean, that's a big list of names right there.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine, like, Brooke Shields as, like, Cherry or Sarah Jessica Parker? I mean,
or Leonardo DiCaprio as Pony Boy?
Well, yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio was, like, 9 at the time. So yeah. I think even though that it was in the notes, he might have been, like, one of the other, like, younger kids in, like, one of the other scenes or something like that.
That's true.
Anthony Michael Hall might have been a little bit older. Maybe he would have been considered for Pony Boy, but I don't, you know.
Yeah, you got to think that Mickey Rourke was probably auditioning for the Patrick Swayze role.
Yeah, for the older, like, older brother role. Yeah, for sure. He might have also been looked too old because, you know, how Mickey Rourke, he's just got an older look.
He does, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even Patrick Swayze was, like, 29 at the time when he did this movie.
Yeah.
When Dallas falls out of his chair at the drive-in, that was not intentional. It was completely accidental. And see Thomas Howell... laughs and looks briefly at the camera while laughing.
Yeah, it's a good little moment in the film for sure.
Yeah, it's funny. It was all shot on location in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And the interesting thing about this that I found is that you can actually visit the main house at 731 Curtis Brothers Lane. It's now a museum dedicated to the Outsiders. The 1920s home was purchased by Danny Boy O'Connor, a founding member of the hip-hop group House of Pain. Danny is a longtime fan of the Outsiders and bought the house for $15,000 and then turned it into the Outsiders Museum. So
that's very cool.
Yeah, the Outsiders Museum is designed to be a museum that's created for the fans and by the fans. Many of the items and exhibits were donated from fans across the world, as there's also been a few different fundraisers. The ribbon cutting and opening, and you probably never heard of this, and the reason why is because the ribbon cutting and opening of the museum was on August 9th, 2019.
Oh, yeah.
Just now open. So the museum does contain Francis Ford Coppola's director's chair and Matt Dillon's jacket. So I thought that was really cool, man.
It is. That's pretty neat.
So, but that just shows you, like you were talking about Ice-T and you know, Ice Cube and Ice Cube being, you know, big fans of the Warriors, and here's like House of Pain, you know, also, you know, being really big fans of this other, you know, sort of gangster movie. It's
kinds of weird overlap for sure.
The author, the original novel, Essie Hinton, she was involved during the filming, and she and Coppola wrote the screenplay together. And appeared as at the end as the nurse in the film. She's the one that shows the knife to or whatever. But also like she was on the set and apparently like I read, I don't know how to like write this, but she was also kind of like very involved in sort of the motherly figure to all the boys that were on the film.
Yeah, it's got to be kind of weird seeing something you created personified so well. And she would have to kind of feel like their mother in a way because she created them. And
yeah, and they probably went to her for advice, like, what would this character do or what would this do? And she really became kind of part of the film as almost like a co-director to the actors, to the boys.
Well, it's certainly very close to the book. That's one thing that really struck me about it was how close it hews to the original text.
In the rumble scene, which I thought was also funny, like we didn't mention this too, is like the Warriors talked about, you know, bopping, right? And then in this movie they talk about rumbling, right?
Yeah. So that's, and they talk about scuffles before the rumble, and they call it jazz. Like, hey, no jazz before the rumble, you know?
In the rumble scene, the first punch is given to Ponyboy C. Thomas Howell. He recalled that the hit was so real, it knocked him out cold.
Huh.
Yeah. Francis Ford Coppola received letters over the years from of the novel, many expressing disappointment that several key scenes were cut and omitted in the film version. They were in Coppola's original cut, but were edited at behest of the studio. So several years later, Coppola's granddaughter was reading the book in class, and was about to watch the film with her fellow schoolmates. Feeling embarrassed, Coppola cobbled together what would eventually become his director's cut, which is The Outsiders, the complete novel, which is, I think, the version that we watched, because it has scenes where Ponyboy gets stalked and jumped. The gangs talked about going to the movies. Soda Pop and Ponyboy talking in the room in Dally. Pony and Johnny bum around before going to the movies, and much of the original score was replaced with music popular in the 60s.
Yeah.
I wondered how he got like all those Elvis songs, because there's no way in crap like they would have the money to pay for that to be released in theaters.
At the time, yeah. But so, yeah, the one thing that's nice is the director's cut or the complete novel version is very easy to come by nowadays. So it's just as common as the theatrical version. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to watch it, I definitely recommend watching this expanded version of it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it moves better, and I think it gives more sort of depth to the movie, and maybe not as criticized as it was that Roger Ebert says, which we'll get to in a minute. But Nicolas Cage, Flea, and Melanie Griffith all have unaccredited cameos as background socias.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Nick Cage was in a lot of Coppola films uncredited.
As he is a Coppola, yeah. I'm just surprised I didn't notice him. Well, you know me, I normally zone right in when Nicolas Cage is there.
There's so many people, it's hard to tell. Scenes where Ponyboy gets stalked and jumped, the gang talks about going to the movies. Soda Pop and Ponyboy talk... Oh, no. Wait, where am I... I'm repeating things.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Lost my place again. During filming, Tom Cruise was cast in Risky Business, and Diane Lane asked Tom to play Lana, and Diane Lane's father told him there was no way in hell she was going to be a hooker in this movie. So Lana went to Rebecca De Mornay.
Yeah, I wish Diane Lane had been in Risky Business for completely personal reasons that I'm not going to go into.
The Outsiders was nominated for 3 Young Artist Awards given annually since Young Artist Awards are given annually since 1978 by the Young Artist Foundation. C. Thomas Howell won for Best Young Motion Picture Actor in a Feature Film. Diane Lane was nominated for Best Young Supporting Actress in a Motion Picture. She lost to Missy Francis in Man, Woman, and Child. I'm sorry, Diane. You should have won.
It's funny how some of those people win those awards you never hear of again. Like, I have no idea who that is.
Well, and even C. Thomas Howell, like, he hasn't been in a whole lot, you know.
Yeah, but he did that to himself. I mean, we said it already once, but he did Soul Man.
Well, Missy Francis is now like a commentator on Fox News.
Oh, is she? Well,
yeah.
Then I'm sorry we brought her up.
The movie The Outsiders was nominated for Best Family Feature Motion Picture, and lost to Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, that's some pretty stiff competition.
Yeah, that's hard to beat. The budget was $10 million, box office $33.7 million. Roger Ebert gave it 2.5 stars,
which is a good rating for him. Again, 4-star scale for him.
Yeah, 2.5 out of 4. But he says the problem with seeing characters in a highly stylized visual way that it's hard for them to breathe and move and get us involved in their stories. That's what happens here. The thin narrative material for The Outsiders only adds up to a movie of 90 minutes, and even there are scenes that seem to be killing time. Nothing that happens in the movie seems necessary. It's all arbitrary.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I mean, so we show Mr. Ebert a lot of respect on this show. He's kind of the patron saint of our show. But he's not always right, as we've said many times. He stated his point very well, but I just disagree with it.
But yes, I disagree with Ebert here, because I think that there's more... like angst and anxiety that he may not be feeling as an adult or remembering like what it was to be a kid and go through these kind of things and to kind of put himself in the place of the characters. And, you know, I don't agree with it, because even though there's not something going on, it's still, you know, tense, I think. Rotten Tomatoes critics score is 63%, The audience is 82%.
That's perfectly fair. Yeah.
There was a television series that aired on Fox for one season from March to July 1990 that followed Married with Children and had 12 episodes and with a 90-minute pilot. And it takes place right where the movie ends.
I kind of remember this. Now that you bring it up, I had completely forgotten, but I kind of remember seeing this.
Yeah, there was a lot of like nostalgia for the 50s and 60s. Because, I mean, around that same time was also like the Wonder Years. And I think that the, you know, the sort of the nostalgia for the Wonder Years kind of said, well, what else can we do? And so, yeah, I think they picked that up for like a season. David Arquette plays 2-Bit and Billy Bob Thornton plays Buck. So there were some other characters that some people may or may not remember from other things, but that was the two that stuck out to me. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, I completely forgot that existed until you bring that up, but I remember seeing an episode or two now. Yeah.
It might be on YouTube somewhere. I haven't looked. Might be somewhere else.
Yeah. I think I'm going to look for that. I think that'll be fun to share on the old Twitter page if we find it.
Yeah, that'd be fun. We'll watch a few episodes and see how it goes.
I'm sure it's terrible.
Well, Fox has a reputation for killing a lot of good shows, though. You know, especially like one-season shows. So, you know, not to try to name, you know, any shows, you know, like, but, you know, hey. All right. So The Warriors, based on the 1965 novel of the same name, written by Sol Yurick. In the book, the protagonists, the Coney Island Dominators, were black and Latino.
Yes.
Yurick is, yeah. And you said before that Yurick is believed to write the story for as a rebuttal to the romanticized gangs of West Side Story that was written in 1961. So Hill, now we mentioned like how comic book that it looked and everything, and Hill was actually a huge fan of comic books and wanted to divide the film in chapters, with each chapter with a intro splash panel.
Yeah. And he eventually did that with the director's cut, which I don't like. That's why I didn't give you that version of it. As much as I think you should watch the director's cut of The Outsiders, avoid the director's cut of The Warriors. It makes it worse.
Yeah, it was scrapped due to budget and trying to rush to release before another rival gang picture was to be released called The Wanderers. Yeah, you can see the splash panels in the director's cut from 2005. Hill also wanted Orson Welles' narrative intro, which that narrative was included on the director's cut, but it was read by Hill himself.
Yeah, and again, as someone who loves The Warriors, I hate it.
Really, so, you don't like it?
Yeah, I don't like it at all.
Okay.
Theatrical version all the way.
Yeah, it sounds cheesy. It sounds like the old Batman and Robin, you know, show with like a bam across the screen or something
we talked about how it walked a fine line of being just serious enough and just silly enough, but not too either way.
Yeah, Batman that came out like 19, like that series, like the Michael Keaton Batman.
Yeah. The comic book panels and the narration pushes that stylization too far.
Too far, okay.
Yeah, and I hate it.
Yeah, I kind of thought that when I read that. The entire film was shot on the streets of New York City during 8 weeks of principal photography, although the bathroom fight scene with the punks was shot at nearby Astoria Studios and also took about 5 days to complete. Crews at night had bricks thrown at them. They were urinated on. They got yelled at. But there were crowds that gathered around wherever they went for people to watch what was going on. You never really see anything. I never really saw any mistakes. The streets look really empty, so they really get a good job of clearing out the crowds, because it really looks like it's, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know.
Yeah.
And probably wasted, you know, a lot of water, like spraying down the streets to make it look that, you know, like really cool look or whatever. But also they paid a local gang to like protect the equipment and stuff like that so that they're, you know.
It sounds only appropriate to me, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and some of the local gangs actually were actually included in the film as well.
Yeah, as bodies for that big gang scene at the beginning. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hill had screened, wait, I'm forgetting stuff. The park in the movie, like I said, was Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx. It's actually as big as it is. It's bigger than Central Park, but it's still not the biggest park in New York City. Central Park is 843 acres. Van Cortlandt is 1,146 acres. It's the city's third largest park. The Central is the fifth largest park. The biggest is Pelham Bay, which is also in the Bronx, and it's 2,772 acres.
Wow.
Yeah. It's on like the very northeast side, like really close to the bay up there. Hill had screened an independent film called Madman with Sigourney Weaver that led Hill to cast her in Alien, but it also featured Michael Beck as the male lead, which led Hill to cast Beck in The Warriors.
I'll have to track that one down. I've never heard of it, so I'll have to go.
Yeah, it's an independent film, so I don't know. Tony Danza was nearly cast as the character Vermin, a soldier and co-founder of the Warriors, but had to turn it down due to be cast in the TV sitcom Taxi.
I guess at the time period he would have fit it, but I mean, I still see Tony Danza as Tony Danza, like.
Yeah,
it would have aged really weird with Tony Danza in it. You know?
Yeah, and Terry Michos was, you know, he played a real sort of comedy, you know, kind of thing. He kept it kind of fun too, you know, because he was the guy that wasn't he the guy that told him that they were the Lizzie's, like they ought to get out of there and stuff like that. Like that was, so yeah, I think that it would have been, or no, there was somebody else, but any which way, I can't remember who was who, but
Vermin was the one who almost gets stabbed by one of the Lizzies, I believe.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Tony Danza would have been maybe a little too serious about it, I think. So actor David Patrick Kelly wanted to use two dead pigeons in the scene with the bottles, but Hill did not think that would work. Instead, Kelly improvised the clinking of the three bottles in his right hand and ad-libbing his famous line, "Warriors." And apparently he did that as an imitation of one of his like really intimidating neighbors.
Hmm.
The Rogue's car in the movie is a 1955 Cadillac hearse. The Warriors movie opened on February 9th, 1979. In 670 theaters without advanced screenings or a decent promotional campaign and grossed $3.5 million on its opening weekend. Just to put it into perspective, the budget was $10 million. So, and they made like, just in 670 theaters, like made $3.5 million. So they're like, okay, this is going to be good. But the studio was concerned about like it being a violent film they were worried about increased violence around it. So that weekend that it was the following weekend, it went to all the theaters and it was linked to sporadic outbreaks of vandalism and even three killings involving moviegoers on their way to or from showings.
Huh.
Paramount then removed ads from radio and TV, added security personnel at theaters, relieved theater owners of contractual obligations to show the movie, and also offered to cover security and damages to the theater. Some even tried to have the movie banned.
Which is really funny in retrospect, because, I mean, it's not very realistic. It's just, it's funny how to look back on things, you know, 40 years later and think, well, that, and all of that for this movie, you know?
I think Walter Hill said it the best. He just said, I think it's just because of the territory, you have a bunch of, it's a male movie and you have a bunch of guys going to the movie, so it's not really the movie per se, it's just that they're all together.
Yeah, small space, testosterone.
Yeah. Well, lost my place again. But even President Reagan was a fan of the film and screened the film at Camp David.
Huh.
Yep.
That's weird.
Yeah. Oh, the budget was only $4 million. I'm sorry. $10 million was The Outsiders. Budget was $4 million. So 3.5, they almost made all of it back in like just 670 theaters. Box office, though, total was kind of squashed because of all of the violence and everything and some theaters pulling out and it kind of getting some bad press. So 22.5 million was the final number. But Rotten Tomatoes critics score, 89%. That's the critics score, mind you. And I don't have... I kind of cobbled these notes together quickly. I don't have the results for the audience.
That's okay.
Hold on. There is the internet available. So just give me a moment.
No problem.
88%. So almost matched. I mean, that's almost 89%, 88%. I consider that a match.
Well, at this point, it's considered a classic, you know?
Right.
Entertain,
yeah. Roger Ebert, though, 2 stars out of 4. Yeah, it's not an movie, okay, by any stretch of the imagination. I really enjoyed it. I'm gonna be honest. I loved it.
It's one of my favorite films. It really is.
So here's his criticism. There's hardly a moment when we believe that the movie gangs are real or that their members are real people or that they inhabit a real city. No matter what the impression ads give, it isn't even remotely intended as an action film. It's a set piece. It's a ballad of stylized male violence.
Yeah, I think he missed the point.
I think he completely missed the point. I think it went... I think... the concept went right over his head.
Yeah. I would have to agree.
Entertainment Weekly named this named The Warriors the 16th greatest cult film on their top 50 greatest cult films list. But it was also 14th in the list of 25 most controversial movies ever. And I think because of the violence and all the protests and stuff like that, that were kind of behind it and behind the violence. So, I mean, you're talking about, like, you know, the late 70s. And you're talking about 1979. Like, yeah. Would you want to go down to New York City at 8 o'clock at night down to Times Square or to Union Square or, any, you know?
I see how that would be a very volatile situation with this film, for sure.
But, and then also, too, director Tony Scott said that he, in a 2005 interview, that he wanted to, that he was going to make a, not just wanted to, but he was going to make a remake of the film in modern-day New York City.
Yeah, he tried for a lot of years before his untimely passing to do that. Like, I mean, it was in constant development. And I really thought it was going to happen for quite a few years, and it never did, sadly.
Yeah, sadly enough, nobody gave it the green light, and unfortunately, we lost Tony Scott in 2012. Just like we lost, you know, other people to mental illness. Unfortunately,
Tony's is a sad story for sure.
Yeah, in July 2016. Joe and Anthony Russo announced they were working with Paramount Television and Hulu for a reimagining Warriors TV series. Of course, we know that never happened.
Yeah.
But well, that's okay, because in 2005, we still have the Warriors like video game, right?
Which is basically like a prequel and a sequel in itself, and there was a comic book sequel as well. So there's definitely more Warriors material out there if you want to get deeper into that world.
Yeah. There's been it's so influential of its cult status. It's just I think it's you know it's I mean Entertainment Weekly gave it what 16th. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I might even give it, I don't know, top 10 somewhere.
It's one of my all-time favorite films. If I was making a top 10 favorite films of my lifetime, it would be on there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Joe Walsh, you know, song at the end was so awesome.
Oh, yeah. And with him walking on the beach as a... Yes, it's so great.
Great. Great. I love it. So
yeah, I mean, like I said, to me, the Warriors is almost perfect. It really is.
Really, you think so? You think it's yeah?
Well, for me, yeah,
yeah. And if you want to know the Simpsons episode, the name of the episode was from 2014, "The Winter of His Content." Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just it's just basically like steals everything from it, basically, just like always that the Simpsons do so well. So yeah, I mean, I just think that, you know, I can't believe it's been, you know, nobody has really, you know, made me sit down and watch this movie before, because you think like, oh, I don't want to watch this gang film. This is going to be like kind of gross and stupid. And it's really not. It's really like a fun sort of adventure, and it's really almost like a page turner, because it's really, you know, this back to the turf thing, and you know,
like it gets your blood pumping.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's, for sure. It's literally thrilling. It gives you a thrill.
Oh yeah, I would agree. And it is kind of weird. Like some of the dialogue is kind of, you know, strange, but you know, I take it for what it is. I mean, if you really take it for it's sort of stylized concept. As long as you accept that stylized concept, then it's a great movie.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, man. I mean, because I'd wanted you to see it for a long time, so it warms my heart that you enjoyed it as much as you did.
I did. I thought it was really great. That was awesome.
Well, that leads us into what we always talk about on the show near the end. If you were going to rent the Warriors from the video store, would you keep it an extra day or would you get it back on time?
Keep it an extra day.
Well, I would as well. I mean, I own this movie. Let's say I've seen it many, many times. I love it to death. What about The Outsiders, Ryan?
I would probably keep it too.
Same. I was surprised how much I enjoyed it on this rewatch. I think it's a great film. I love the story. It takes me back to a simpler time in my life. It was like falling down a little bit of a nostalgia hole to go back and revisit it. It made me feel like a kid again, reading the story for the first time.
Yeah, it really, like I said, it's one of those great coming of age movies that I, you know, watch as a kid. And like I said, a lot of people probably, you know, were made to watch this movie in class or whatever. And, you know, you can think that it's like kind of cheesy or whatever, like these greases and socias and stuff like that. But I mean, I think it still captured about a lot what was happening at the time. I mean, you know, it's almost like this movie is like kind of a antithesis to Grease, just as, you know, the Warriors is like kind of a antithesis to, rebuttal, I should say, not antithesis or rebuttal to West Side Story. Yeah. So to me, that's what I really sort of got out of it or whatever. But, yeah, I think it's a great film. And I think that, you know, it's a great book as well.
It's always nice on the show when we have when we watch two films that we both think are really great. Yeah. It's never any fun when we're like, yeah, both these are just kind of okay.
This is kind of okay. No, they were both incredibly enjoyable, and it's still. I think it's awesome that we can watch two sort of like, you know, well, I mean, really, The Outsiders was kind of a period film, but like The Warriors was almost a period film too because it was made like so, you know, it was made back in the late 70s or whatever. Yeah. And so stylized, but like how they're both about gangs, but like they're so sort of different in their tone and like what they're really, you know, what the really overall message is. And I think that these two movies go together better than any other movies that we've done, I think.
Yeah, I think they play really well as a double feature, and it shows how you can take two concepts that are very similar, even with similar themes, give them to two very different artists and have the artist turn in really singular works.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I completely agree. So that brings us to, you know, where do we go from here? What sort of, and I'll go first this time.
Okay.
The movie that I just kept thinking about, and not really with the Warriors. The Warriors to me was like so stylized. I don't know if I have a, you know, sort of suggestion for it, but everything about The Outsiders just made me think of Stand By Me. And I think that that's also another one of these great sort of adventure stories where these kids are together and they're trying to get to this like body. And it's a great adaptation from a Stephen King short story. And, you know, it's also in that like kind of late 50s or early, you know, 60s period. And where you're talking, you know, with Grisha, you know, Grease, you know, whatever. And I really love that film. I think it goes well with The Outsiders.
I think that's an excellent, excellent suggestion. As far as one that I think would work with the Warriors, it's another Walter Hill film called Southern Comfort. It's about a National Guard troop, a group of reservists who are on maneuvers in a Louisiana swamp, and they run afoul of like the local like rednecks. And they basically have to try to get away and survive while these hillbillies are basically chasing them. And it's got a lot of similar stylistic, at least from like concept and structure, as The Warriors. And it stars Powers Booth, and it's a really great kind of, again, lean, mean kind of chase movie.
Mm-hmm.
So stylistically, I think it would fit well. It's like the rural version of The Warriors, where The okay. Warriors is very urban.
Right.
Southern Comfort is very like rural.
So that's almost like a mix of like, because it has power. I mean, I know it has Powers Booth in it, like from Red Dawn, but it's almost like a kind of a Warriors and Red Dawn sort of mix.
Yeah, well, there's all kinds of weird overlap in these things when we get to talking about them. Like it all yeah. kind of interconnects.
Yeah, it does. I mean, and you definitely see how, you know, certain directors. I mean, part of what makes them who they are, and part of what makes them so great. Is the style that they bring, you know what I mean? So yeah, yeah, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. So, but yeah, definitely interesting. I'll have to check that out. If I have time to watch all these movies, Essery.
Hey man, we'll get to them eventually, man. We're about to do Powers Booth or another Walter Hill episode at some point. So maybe we'll sneak that one in there.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up on here on Video Culture. Hopefully you guys are, you know, keeping it safe, keeping it real, not bopping each other or rumbling. So if you want to bop us one, you know, send us an email, comment, tweet at us. Yeah. We'd love to hear from you.
We would, man. And you guys be safe. You know, the world's a crazy place right now. Watch out for yourselves and, you know, just be good to each other. And most importantly, guys, just for fun, let's watch some movies.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, come hang out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
Armies of the night.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
The Furies. The Boppers. The Hi-Hats. The Lizzies. The Turnbull ACs. The Gramercy Riffs.
Riffs! Yeah, right!
And these are the Warriors.
We know about the Warriors. They're a heavy outfit.
character from Coney Island.
Warriors, you guys are the big dudes, huh?
Now, they're in the Bronx.
We're going back.
27 miles behind enemy lines.
It's the only choice we got.
Between them and safety stand 20,000 cops. And 100,000 sworn enemies.
I want them all. I want all the warriors.
They've got one way out. They've got one chance. They've got one night. The Warriors.